What's up, guys? Get ready for a fucking ride, because it's time for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Alrighty. So first, apologies that this episode is late. I always feel a little weird saying that because I don't know. I don't know how many people, care, but I care. It matters to me, and I don't like when I have things out late. But, you know, unfortunately, just a lot of things are out of my control, especially when it comes to the things that are wrong with my body. Which would be a very long conversation that I'm sure a lot of people don't want to hear. So I'm going to keep that one to myself. Maybe for now. I don't know. To be honest, guys, I'm having a hard fucking time. Super hard time. And I think I might have a hard time getting through this episode because of what this movie means to me. Rewatching it has just brought up a lot of stuff. Nothing really super new, I guess. It's just so, I guess, fascinating to me to re-examine my first experiences and attachments with these things. And even though they're just movies, they mean a lot to me. And I understand that a lot of people might not get that, you know, especially if it's not your experience or, I don't know, you just can't relate in any sort of way. I often feel like I seem ridiculous. But I think a lot of that probably just comes from my insecurities and, projecting them onto myself or amplifying them because anyways, now I'm not making sense, but Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I'm going to do some movie facts per usual. And then of course, recap the movie. I don't really know how to talk about this right now without crying. And I hate how I sound when I can tell that I was holding back tears and frustration. I don't know why I said frustration, but I guess because I get frustrated with myself for crying. I cry a lot. Usually alone, and I don't really want to start bawling into a podcast episode, especially because even if I do, I'm probably just going to cut it, cut that shit. But also, it doesn't do any good to just leave the crying audio in. Who the fuck wants to listen to that? It's okay to cry, but my nose runs when I cry. So, then it's just boogers and mess, and that's foul. Ew. Anyways. I feel like I'm going to have a hard time being my more upbeat self with this movie, so I guess just prepare for that. I don't know. I'm rambling a little bit. I'm trying to collect myself. I guess here we go. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It came out in 1987. It was written and directed by John Hughes. So Sir John Hughes here, he wrote and directed Home Alone. So, we're a little familiar with this guy. And the more I get into the world of John Hughes, the more I want to know. I forget the name of it. Of course I do. But there is a documentary on John Hughes that I really want to find and watch. Let's do our cast real quick. Steve Martin is here. My love and adoration for Steve Martin. Please be with us forever. I fucking love that guy. He plays Neil Page, one of our two main characters. John Candy is our other main character. He plays Del Griffith. I had thought about and considered doing a bit of a breakdown on John Candy's, life and body of work, but I think I'm going to save that for Uncle Buck. When I do that movie, I don't know when I'm going to do Uncle Buck because fuck, this movie hit me so hard. I'm like, I don't even know what I'm going to do. I don't even know what I'm going to do next. Oh wait, no, I did decide what I'm going to do next, but I'm not telling you yet. Layla Robbins plays Susan Page, Neil's wife. Olivia Burnett plays Marty Page, the daughter of Neil and Susan. Larry Hankin plays a taxi driver named Doobie. So Larry Hankin, we saw him in Home Alone as well. He played Sergeant Balzac, donut sergeant guy in Home Alone. But he was also Mr. Heckles and Friends, which I completely missed in my recap of Home Alone. I recognized him and I recognized the name, but I'm not super familiar with him. But when I was reading about this, I was like, wait a minute, that's fucking Mr. Eccles and Friends. But he was also in Breaking Bad, movies like Escape from Alcatraz and Billy Madison. Michael McKean, he plays a state trooper. Michael McKean, he was on SNL and I put his body of work within my movie notes. So when I get there, I'll let you know. Because if I try to scroll for it right now, I'm gonna fuck everything up in my head. Matthew Lawrence plays Neil Page Jr., the son of Neil and Susan. He's so little. You don't see him much. But when I saw his little face, I was like, shit, is that one of the Lawrence brothers? Well, hello, sir. We get a little scene with Ben Stein again. I feel like he pops up in his third pop-up in a movie I've done for this so far. But yeah, he plays the Wichita Airport representative. Edie McClurg plays a car rental agent. So when I saw her, I was like, man, she's so familiar. And her voice is kind of like, I don't know, iconic to me in a way. Because it's just, you hear it and you're like, wait a minute, I know this person. So she was in movies like Carrie. You know, like, how do I describe Carrie? Pig Blood. The Bucket of Plague. Oh, God. Pig Blood. At the prom, and you know, she's moved things with her mind and her mom's real religious and they all die. Anyways, she was also in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and she's done a ton of voice acting stuff for things like The Little Mermaid, Cars, I believe the first two films in the Cars franchise, A Bug's Life, and Wreck-It Ralph. I fucking love Wreck-It Ralph, the first and the second one. You know, second movies, they don't always do as well, but I really liked the second movie in the Wreck-It Ralph world. I want more. And then Dylan Baker plays Owen Mooney. We'll get to that in a little bit, but he plays this, I don't even know how to describe him, guy who helps drive them from one location to the next in the movie. So that's all I'll say on that for now. All right, let's jump into our movie facts. I wasn't sure where I was going to stick this in, but I guess I'll just do it here. I was listening to an episode of Fly on the Wall. It's a podcast by David Spade and Dana Carvey. And it was, I think it's an older episode, but it just popped up for me. It was randomly on YouTube. I'm never on YouTube. But yeah, it just popped up for me. It was an episode with Martin Short and Steve Martin. And as I was listening to it this past week, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles came up. And it was such a treat to hear Steve Martin talk about the movie. But it had come up because they were talking about John Candy. So I just want to play a part of that real quick. It's our little movie fact experience by way of, you know, people much more important and interesting than I. So here we go.
When Planes, Trains, does that come written funny and written for you too? Or is one of you guys attached? And
first
you think
of all,
the other one?
The script was fantastic. It was written by John Hughes. Supposedly he wrote it over a weekend. And when I got the script, I think it was 152 pages long. And a normal script is maybe 110 or 112. So I said to him, God, the script's so good, John. Congratulations. What are you going to cut? And he said, cut. And the first draft of the film came in at 4.5 hours.
Wow.
But anyway, and then he encouraged John and I to ad-lib. And like there's a lot of ad-lib scenes. Like in the motel room, we're kind of giggling and laughing. And then some jokes we just made up, like Those Aren't Pillows was made up on the set.
Really? That's kind of that's the line of the
big trailer line too. Yeah.
Yeah. Those aren't pillows.
He was so sweet and we got along so great. In fact, we made a deal at some point about 3 weeks in, we said we'd ad-lib a scene and then they'd have to cover the ad-lib. So a scene that might take an hour was now starting to take 3 hours. And we said, we made a deal, no more ad-libbing. We're not going to ad-lib anymore. But he would make me laugh so much. He would do a gladiator movie, like an Italian dubbed gladiator movie where he would say the line in Italian and then his lips would keep moving like it was dubbed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was.
Pardon before your queen, centurion.
And then his lips will move.
Anyway.
Yeah. Now, John was an angel. I can still see John walk in this door right now. That's what a strong.
And he had a presence. Great laugh. He loved to laugh. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
I think I could listen to Steve Martin talk forever. And I think I could listen to people who, you know, specifically knew John Candy, talk about him forever. I think I teared up a little bit when I was listening to it. Okay, so before John Hughes, our director, passed away, he said that there is a 3-hour version of the film that's locked away in a vault. It's a total mess of footage, and it would take months, maybe even years, to put into a workable film. But he also said that most of it's probably deteriorated as well, which is kind of a bummer. I would love to just see a long-ass cut of that film. I don't know if I could make it through a 3-hour version of... Well, I don't make it through a 3-hour version... 3-hour movies well in general. But I think I would still like to experience it at least once, you know? Okay, so the house that we see in the movie, that's Neil's house. He lives in Chicago. First, it looks a lot like the Home Alone house. It's not. But it is on the same block as the Home Alone house, which I was like, well, shit, I knew it. I knew there was something the same here, similar at least. But anyways, Neil's house was the exterior of the house, like the street that they film on is the same street, but it's, you know, not the same house. Anyways, Neil's house was a set built from scratch, and it consisted of 7 rooms, and it took 5 months to complete. It ended up costing $100,000, which pissed off the Paramount executives and caused some trouble on set. And I just kind of thought that was funny, because when you read about John Hughes, it just kind of seemed like if they were giving him shit for things like this, he didn't care. He just kept doing his John Hughes thing. And I'm like, I like that. I could have that wrong, but that's the impression I was kind of getting. Okay, I loved this. So John Candy and Steve Martin, you know, they play Neil and Del. The scene where they're on the plane, it's kind of the beginning of the movie, there was a scene that ended up being cut. It's not in the theatrical version. I think it's when it was aired in the televised version. I don't know if that's still the case, but at some point it was. So there's this scene on the plane where they eat dinner. And the scene ends with a long-haired passenger in front of Steve Martin, playing Neil, letting their hair cascade down onto Neil's brownie, completely covering it. You know what? My sensory issues say, no, I can't handle this. I'm glad I didn't have to see it. There's just something about hair, even if logically you're like, this is clean hair. I think it's, for me, just a sensory thing. Hair and food, no. It's a big no for me. It bothers me a lot. But apparently for Del in the movie, it wasn't an issue for him, because in the scene, Del fishes through the hair to retrieve it and eats the brownie. And I'm like, all right. Clearly not everyone is the same. And this is where Del and I differ. Okay, let's learn a little bit more about Dylan Baker, who I mentioned in the cast list. He plays the sordid and scary son of a motel manager that Neil and Del first stay at in Wichita. So Dylan Baker, he created the Owen character himself. He improvises the snorts and loogie hacks and twisted expressions. So I'm going to have to explain this a little bit more if I'm going to give you this fact now, you know. He seems to be a chewing tobacco guy, and he just, like, the snorts and the hacking, like, he just keeps doing it, and it's disgusting, and it's fucking foul. And the character he plays is just a rough fucking guy. Like, I don't even know how to describe him any other way but, like, a rough fucking guy. No, I do know how to describe him. I'll say it again, you know, when we get into the recap part of this, but when this bitch steps out of his little pickup truck, I was like, oh, you know who they remind me of? Roland Shit from Schitt's Creek. If I can throw in a Schitt's Creek reference, you know I'm gonna. Owen must be some fucking cousin, maybe even the evil twin of Roland Shit, because he's much more foul than Roland, and Roland can be foul.
Quite frankly, your lifestyle choices are making me just a little nervous.
Don't worry about me. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good.
Oh, she's a little piece of skin back there. I got it. Still good.
A Lulie Newcomb, who played his wife, silent wife, she doesn't actually have any speaking lines, I don't think. I might be fucking that up. There's this line when they meet his wife, when Owen comes to pick them up, where Owen says, she birthed her baby sideways and didn't cry. She said it was difficult to keep a straight face while filming together, but despite Dylan Baker's antics as Owen, John Hughes still wasn't satisfied with the initial reactions he was getting from Steve Martin and John Candy during Owen's introduction scene. So John Hughes, he privately told Dylan Baker to spit in his hand before shaking hands with Neil, Steve Martin's character. So when Neil's face contorts with disgust, that's just Steve Martin's genuine reaction, and big fucking same. Big fucking same. Okay, you know I love a good music fact, so here's a pretty good one for you guys. So John Hughes movies, whatever, they're known for having memorable theme songs, main songs, whatever you want to call that. So like for The Breakfast Club, there's Don't You Forget About Me. Don't you forget about me. No one said I could sing. I wish I could. Anyways, yeah, National Lampoon's Holiday Road. Ah, Holiday Road. I can't get that one out of my brain enough. Just, you know, not kill your ears with me trying to sing it. So anyways, during the production for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, you know, they wanted to follow suit in a big way with a specially written and produced song by Elton John. According to lyricist Gary Osborne, who was also brought onto the movie to compose the song with Elton John, the pair had come real close to finalizing the song before there was some, in quotes, contractual technicalities, which stopped everything in its tracks. I guess pun intended, because Planes, Trains, Automobiles. Anyways, just 2 days before Elton John was supposed to record the theme song, he and his team had to pull out of the film. It turns out, fucking Paramount, fucking showed up behind the scenes. Paramount wanted to own the master of Elton John's song for the movie, which was something Elton John's own contract couldn't allow. So instead, Paramount decided to try to use Paul Young's Every Time You Go Away, but that didn't work out either because Paul Young's record company, Columbia Records, said no. So another cover of that song was produced. Paul Young himself was super disappointed by this. Apparently he was a big fan of Steve Martin and John Candy. Can we just let the artists run things sometimes? I know that that's not always the best way to go, but sometimes I feel like we need that a little bit more. Anyways, so I found this really great article from Vanity Fair. Well, I thought it was a really great article, but it's really just an oral history. So it's a bunch of quotes. So I really enjoyed it because they're first account quotes from people involved in the film or knew some of the actors or John Hughes, the director, for example. So I love the firsthand account part of it. I did have a hard time reading it though, because it's just a bunch of fucking quotes. So while I really enjoy that kind of stuff, it felt a little disjointed, but I say it was really great because I love the firsthand account quotes and things like that. And it was nice to kind of have it compiled there. So per usual, all my stuff will be in the show notes, but I pulled some of my favorite quotes from it, and I'm going to try to make sense of it for you guys. Here we go. In a quote from Michael McKean, who again played a state trooper, he said, "We shot the full day and then overnight it snowed, so we couldn't shoot the rest of it. We had to go back and start again because now things looked a lot different. So essentially we shot the thing twice in two different days." I wanted to include that one specifically because I felt like it was a good starting point to establish that the filming of the movie was very much like the movie itself. They were constantly chasing snow, so the scheduling was constantly getting changed. They were jumping around to a lot of different locations last second. You know, things were being changed on the fly. So the movie depicts a lot of travel woes and like crazy things happening that impedes them getting home and, you know, getting back on time. Well, the same thing was kind of happening behind the scenes trying to shoot the damn thing. And I don't know, I kind of love that. I mean, I don't love, you know, that was their experience, but it kind of sounds like, at least looking back on it now, it gives them more of a laugh and a giggle, and it's like an endearing memory. I hope, I don't want to assume, but anyways, Steve Martin, in an interview, he said, quote, "We actually lived the plot of the movie. As we would shoot, we were hopping trains, planes, and automobiles trying to find the snow." That's a quote from John Hughes, A Life in Film, and that's the documentary that I was trying to remember, you know, just a little bit ago and couldn't remember the name of. The best illustration of the touch-and-go nature of the shoot, of making this movie, is probably the story of character actor Troy Evans, who was just starting out in 1987. He was hired for what was intended to be a one-day, one-line role. He plays the cheese truck driver at the end of their journey, So at the, I know we're a little bit of a spoiler here. At the end of the film, their last leg before they actually hit Chicago, they hitch a ride with a semi-truck driver, and it turns out he's driving a truck full of cheese. Literally, you barely even see him on the screen. So it's a very, very small role, right? I love how he's labeled, his character's labeled as antisocial trucker. So Troy Evans, in a quote from him, he said, quote, "They hired me and I was going to shoot in LA and they offered me $1,000 for this one day to go in and say that one line. Then my agent called a couple of days later and said, they've decided they're going to shoot that scene in New York. And I said, so am I off the movie? No, no, no. You'll go to New York. Well, about this time, they decided that they would use this scene as their cover set because there was threatening snow. So they're holding me. If it snows, then they'll shoot this with me in the truck with the snow blowing." This is why there's constantly chasing fucking snow. End quote. I forgot to say that. But it didn't snow, and they kept holding Troy Evans for his one scene at $1,000 a day. As the company moved from Buffalo to Ohio to St. Louis to Illinois, taking him along for the ride to each new location. So just like, can you imagine? You're just starting out. You land a real small role in a John Hughes movie. And listen, he's done so many iconic things, but I feel like especially during this time frame, but I might be incorrect on that, but like, it's Steve Martin and John Candy, you know? And then you just keep on, you were supposed to be done in a day. And then you just stay on because they're chasing the snow and you're just on for this whole experience. And I don't know. I just kind of love that story. In another quote from Troy Evans, he said, quote, "I don't remember. It was 11 cities total. Ended up, I'm pretty sure we finally shot the scene in Kanaki, Illinois." I don't know if I said that right. "On my 51st day. So I left home not having $300 in rent. And when I went back home, having done my one line in the movie, we bought our first house." End quote. That's wild to me. Fucking wild. As the weather interfered with shooting days and travel days were added, the schedule and budget for the film just blew the fuck up. The production started in Buffalo, moved to Kanaki, Woodstock, Gurnee, Kenilworth, and Chicago, Illinois, and zipped over to St. Louis and New York City before landing in Los Angeles for soundstage shooting. In an interview with Paul Hirsch, who was an editor, he said, quote, "They shot 85 days. You know, normally on a two-character comedy, you'd shoot 36 days. 40 days. 85 days is unheard of. 85 days is what you scheduled for Mission Impossible or something." End quote. Okay, so I didn't mention this yet because I wanted to mention it here, but we have a very quick but memorable, noticeable cameo with Kevin Bacon at the beginning of this movie. He plays it's just called Taxi Racer. No lines. He literally is just racing Steve Martin, Neil, for a taxi. So this is a quote from Kevin Bacon on his little cameo bit role in this film. He said, quote, "We finished She's Having a Baby, and in the course of making that film, John and I had become very close. You know, I was essentially playing him, and so we ended up spending a lot of time together. I think for various reasons, I was at a point in my life where I didn't want that to end, in a funny kind of way, you know?" And he said, "I'm going to go and do this movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Steve and John." And I said, "Hey, put me in the movie. I'll do anything. You can make me an extra." And so basically he did. I was an extra with a trailer. End quote. So She's Having a Baby, maybe that's another John Hughes movie. That's who he's referring to. I mean, you know, I kind of figured it out as the quote went on, but I thought I'd just clarify. And it wasn't until my first rewatch of this movie recently, I hadn't watched this movie in a very long time, that I even clocked, oh shit, that is Kevin Bacon. Bacon is here. Bacon is everywhere, but he's also here. In another quote from Kevin Bacon on John Hughes, he said, "He wasn't precious about his own dialogue. He was precious about his characters." The oral history, this Vanity Fair article, is probably what started to endear me and want to learn more about John Hughes, because reading some of the quotes from people talking about him and his process, I don't know, I just found it fascinating and I guess kind of inspiring. In another quote, the person who said this, oh, I forgot to write down their full name, because it just says Baker. I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to fix that. But anyways, for now, they said, "The joke I heard was that they always had somebody, some assistant to a producer, who was following John Hughes around, because when he went into the restroom, he'd come out with 10 additional pages." It's like his brain was constantly creating and expanding and learning the thing that he had created, this like the script for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It was like he was it was just constantly evolving, but not necessarily in a bad way, you know, like it was just getting better. In a quote from John Candy on John Hughes, he said, "John loves to do that. John loves to improvise," which I don't know why, because his scripts are so good. I think it's almost like he just needed to look at it from all angles and just try it all of these different ways just to make sure what he had was the best. Or, you know, if as the thing went along, if something else would have been better like this way, you know, he has that option for the final cut. Two more things and we're going to get into the recap. I know this is turning out to be longer than I intended, but here we are. My jaw is also fucking killing me, so I feel like I'm talking a little bit slower than normal, but, you know, thank you, TMJ disorder, that I have severe paranoia about. I've convinced myself I'm just, like, losing my jaw. There's a couple quotes here on John Candy. I could talk about him forever. I could have selected more, but I just was like, okay, Megan, you know, cut yourself off a little bit here. In a quote from Troy Evans, again, he was just the antisocial trucker. This is his character's title. He said, quote, "It was the night of the Oscars and the phone rings. I'm sitting in my underwear in my room, eating room service and watching the TV. And the phone rings. Is this Troy? I said, yeah. Troy, this is John Candy. I'm having a few folks up to watch the Oscars and wonder if you'd like to join us. I was so excited. You know, John Hughes will be there. The producers will be there. And maybe I'll meet Steve Martin. I didn't have any dress clothes, but I cleaned up as best as I could and went up to John Candy's room. He was in the same hotel, you know, and John Hughes wasn't there. The producers weren't there. And Steve Martin wasn't there. Who was there was everybody who was like me on the movie. He went through all the down the ladder actors and invited them up to his suite. Isn't that wonderful? And then he got like $1,000 worth of room service. He got like 20 pizzas and just the food just kept coming all evening. And so as I was leaving, I tried to slip him $200 to help him with food. And I remember this on my deathbed. John Candy said, Troy, that's been taken care of. You know that question, like a conversation starter? I can't think of an occasion besides when an actor is asked this in an interview where it's asked, but that question, you know, if you could invite anyone to dinner, dead or alive, who would it be? I John Candy would 100%, 1,000%, 1,000,000%. Why did I say it like that? Doesn't matter. Be on that list. Okay, and then last quote on John Candy. This is actually from his daughter, Jennifer Candy. And I wanted to mention this specifically because Del's hair and the mustache he has, Lord, is it an experience. And when I saw this, I was like, oh God, I gotta include this. So anyways, Jennifer Candy, she said, this was the first role that I really noticed him prepping the character. He really planned the facial hair. He really planned the hair, like Del Griffith had to have a perm. And we went and got a perm. I remember him coming home with dark hair and a perm. So it was like, okay, this is what he's doing now. I hate the mustache that his character has, that Del Griffith has. I fucking hate it. I kind of love it now for the behind the scenes things. Automobiles. It opens with Neil at a boring as fuck meeting in New York City. He's come from Chicago. He's in advertisement or something like that. The room is awkwardly silent as some apparently speechless head honcho dude is seated up there at his fucking desk staring at some mock-ups for a makeup ad. Neil is trying to silently express that he needs to fucking go across the table to his coworker. He's got a flight to catch. He's trying to catch a 6 p.m. flight home for Thanksgiving. The head guy they are waiting on must be a fucking mime because all he does is move his mouth like he's about to speak and kind of bump around in his wheelie chair and then not speak. Finally, we see Neil and the other guy he works with heading towards the elevators. Neil is fucking determined to make this flight. His coworker hangs back, accepting that it's impossible. They're not gonna make this 6 p.m. flight trying to catch a cab in, you know, rush hour traffic in New York City. But Neil here is like, no, I'm gonna make this flight.
I'll see you in Chicago, John.
You'll never make this in.
Okay, I know I said this before, but I didn't register before that Kevin Bacon is here for a hot minute, because when we see Neil on the street trying to hail down a cab, he ends up racing a guy on the opposite side of the street. They've been looking for a taxi. Everyone's looking for a taxi. And there's a taxi just a little bit up ahead in traffic who they've got their... I don't really know how taxis work, to be honest. Not in this way. The land of before Uber, but the taxi light is on. So I guess that means it's available. And they both clock it. They're like, okay, this guy also sees it. I need this fucking cab. And they just start fucking booking it and racing one another. I I love seeing Kevin Bacon's face pop up for a moment. Makes me want to go watch everything that he's in, like Flatliners, for example. So yeah, they foot race to the death, literally almost to Neil's death, because Neil trips over some luggage, a giant trunk to be specific, and falls into traffic. And it's by Bacon, hello candy. So as Neil sweeps himself off from almost getting ran over, he looks down at what he tripped over. It's a trunk with the name Del Griffith on it. He's angry, but he moves on, still needing a taxi, and ends up haggling with some Wall Street looking rat who turns out to be a lawyer for his cab.
Anyone who'd pay $50 for a cab certainly pay $75.
Not necessarily. All right, $75.
You're a thief. Close. I'm an attorney.
He ends up paying this dude $75 for the cab, but as he was haggling with him, Dell was getting into his cab, unaware that the sidewalk cabbie haggle was over the cab that he's getting the fuck into. Just as Neil hands some cash over to the rat attorney, the taxi squeals off into traffic, and Neil goes chasing after it.
All right, you son of a bitch, this is my cab, ow!
The taxi hits a red light and he flings the cab door open. The look on Dell's face is fucking priceless. It's all surprise squirrel-like. It's hilarious. I could have a flash of that little scene in my head forever and continue to giggle at it. So yeah, Neil doesn't get that cab that he just gave a guy $75 for. No, he does not. But he does make it to the airport. We see him running through the crowd in the airport, weaving as fast as possible in and out of the hordes of people also trying to, you know, do their airport thing. But when he gets to his gate, he discovers his flight's been delayed. We see him call home to let his family know about the delay, and then he begins to wait. So as he's seated at the terminal, he recognizes the guy from the cab sitting across from him.
I know you, don't I? I'm usually very good with names, but I'll be damned if I haven't forgotten yours.
You stole my cab.
I've never stole anything in my life.
I hailed a cab on Park Avenue this afternoon, and before I could get in it, you stole it.
You're the guy who tried to get my cab. I knew I knew you, yeah. You scared the bejesus out of me.
You scared the bejesus out of me. I love this interaction. Dell is just so, it's like he's just so unaware of the world around them, around himself, but he always has a smile on his face about it. And I didn't realize how much I was relating to the way that Dell operates, not in all aspects, but this man is clearly neurodivergent. I would throw a guess out there to say he is all ADHD. And I love that about him. I love that about this character. Y'all know I have my qualms about neurodivergent qualities being used to create these iconic characters, but the thing never actually being said. And again, I know it's not the movie's responsibility to teach me about neurodivergence. I just get very worked up about it because I see it so often and I see it in so many things now, but the thing is never actually said what it is. And I don't like that. I don't like that because if there was better information and representation out there for neurodivergence, then I wouldn't get worked up about it. But there isn't. So this is why I'm pointing it out, because I want to change that. You scared the bejesus out of me. I just I have it in italics in my notes, so my eye just went straight back to it again. As Dell kind of thinks on what Neil just said here, he realizes it was awful easy to get a cab during rush hour in New York fucking city. And I've never been, but you know, I hear that it's a real wild experience trying to get places by way of car. Anyways, so he realizes, well, I did steal your cab. I'm so fucking sorry. So he apologizes and he starts offering to buy him a meal, sort of repayment for Neil's grievance over this. But Neil says no.
Let me make it up to you somehow, huh, please? How about a nice hot dog and a beer?
No, thanks.
Just a hot dog, then.
I'm kind of picky about what I eat.
Some coffee?
No.
Milk?
No.
Soda?
No.
Some tea?
No.
Lifesavers?
No.
This is where I just start relating to Neil, because all of his food things, I'm like, yeah, big same. I could not take my eye off Dell's mustache in this scene. I hate it, but I can't stop looking at it. It's like a little lip rat moving when he speaks. Neil boards his flight, but instead of taking his seat, he's quiet arguing with the flight attendant about his seating arrangement. So I say quiet arguing because I don't know how to describe what he's doing any other way but that, because that's just exactly what he's doing. And you'll see him argue this way up until the end of the film, where he finally just goes off the deep end a little bit here. He has a first class ticket, but since the flight was delayed and whatever the issue was, it bumped his seat to coach. So she's explaining to him that she can't do anything about it now. He would have had to go to the desk inside to try to fix this, because they're actively boarding this flight. Like, they're literally standing on the plane. But Neil isn't having it.
Save your boarding pass and you'll get a refund on the difference.
I don't want a refund. I want a seat in first class where I was booked and ticketed over a month ago.
Look, I have had just about enough of you. Now take your seat.
Oh, you had about enough of me. First you delay me, then you bump me. I can't wait to see what happens next.
Oh, Neil, I feel like every time he takes issue with someone, he ends up summoning Del. And that perhaps maybe this is his limbo, because he ends up seated in a middle seat between some old guy and Del.
Is this a coincidence or what? Have a seat.
Del, chomping on some fucking gum, officially introduces himself.
I never did introduce myself. Del Griffith. American Light and Fixture, Director of Sales, Shower Curtain Ring Division. I sell shower curtain rings. Best in the world. And you are?
Neil Page.
Neil Page. Pleased to meet you, Neil Page. So what do you do for a living, Neil Page?
I had a real hard time watching this scene because of the gum. The fucking gum. I'm really glad that he doesn't continue to do this throughout the rest of the movie, because I don't know if I would have made it. The sound of someone chewing gum turns me murderous. Del keeps talking at him. Neil, he did tell him, hey, I'm not really a conversationalist. I just want to read my article. And Del was like, oh yeah, sure, no problem. But continues to fucking talk. Del just can't seem to turn himself off. He keeps speaking, even though he was just like, oh yeah, you know, I hate those chowder heads or whatever he calls them, who just don't know when to quit. Del, you are that guy right now. But Neil, it's like he just continues to be polite while he is fucking dying on the inside. And I know it's not the same thing, but the way Neil seems to be unable to like completely express what he needs, or that he just, for example, I mean, we're here anyway. He did say to Del, I don't want to talk. But then Del keeps doing that. But Neil also, he doesn't feel comfortable, or he can't, or I don't even know why, saying, okay, but you're still doing it. And then fucking Del, he pulls an ultimate public courtesy faux pas on a plane, nonetheless. And he takes off his fucking shoes and then his socks. And he's flapping his socks around in Neil's fucking face. And bitch, you can't smell it through the screen, but you can tell it must smell real fucking bad, because Neil looks like he wants to die. And then he might vomit. But yet again, he still isn't like, hey, dude, can you just fucking not?
Oh. Oh, that feels good. Oh, God, I'm telling you. My dogs are barking today. Whew. Oh. That feels better.
It's almost like he's so uptight that he's silent. I guess it reminds me a lot. These two characters, they remind me so much of myself, but just like these two like really big halves of myself. There's Del, who's boisterous, loud, does whatever the fuck he wants, kind of. He's nice, like he's a kind guy, he's funny, he will help you out, he will go out of his way. But he also does things like take off his fucking shoes on an airplane when his feet reek. And then to top it off, he takes off his socks. You know, I don't do that. I promise you. I will never be the person on the plane who takes off their shoes and then goes to the bathroom barefoot. I don't understand that. But that's when I start to relate to Neil, because Neil, it's like he's trying so hard to be a pillar of like neurotypical society, that he's just fucking suffering on the inside constantly. And like there's this pent up rage that eventually comes out. But even when like it fully wants to come out, he's still quiet about it. But it's like he's just trudging along fucking, I don't know, kind of suffering in ways. But he can't verbalize it. And it's just like this, I know again, like his character is not the same thing as my life experience. They just kind of each feel like two halves of a very fucking difficult life experience. And it's very, I don't know, I guess it's interesting and unnerving to see it displayed like that. And then to think back to my young self watching this and relating and not even knowing why. It's such a weird thing to think about. I was relating to it and falling in love with these people, but like I didn't actually fucking know why. And again, it's so, I guess, kind of wild to me that I was scrambling for understanding in all of these different ways, but I found it in movies, in fictional stories. And even when I was finding it, I still didn't know why I needed these things so much and created these huge attachments to them so much. Like there was this internal connection to it, but I didn't have like a cognizant understanding of it. I guess that's why I get so emotional, because I'm now going back to these things and understanding it. It's just, I don't know. It's sad. It's depressing. I feel pathetic. I feel lame. God, this episode's gonna be like 5 hours long because I can't shut up. But anyways, eventually Del falls asleep. He's snoring like a creature from Middle Earth. He's fallen asleep kind of like on Neil's shoulder. The old guy by the window has also kind of fallen asleep on Neil. And Neil is just quiet, suffering. And then Del, he wakes up just for a moment to say,
$6 in my right nut says we're not landing in Chicago.
Del is Neil's hell, but he's also right. We see clips of Neil's house, his wife and kids when he calls home, which he is about to do again because, like I just said, Del, he's right. Their flight lands in Wichita. So now he's stuck in Wichita. He makes his phone call and then Del starts chatting at him again. Neil asks him what's the deal with the flight, and Del says,
simple. There's no way on earth we're gonna get out of here tonight. We'd have more luck playing pickup sticks with our butt cheeks than we will getting a flight out of here before daybreak.
Just as he finishes saying this, Ben Stein, who's playing flight attendant employee guy, I don't know his official title, but here we are, Mr. Dry Eye Guy, Kerrigan's dad's lawyer from Casper, pops onto the intercom.
You're saying I could be stuck in Wichita?
I'm saying you are stuck in Wichita.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? I'm sorry to announce that we're canceling flight 909 due to severe weather in Chicago.
I was fucking dying with this little clip of a scene because, you know, it's Ben Stein and I get a little giggle out of seeing him. I like it. But then the reader board behind him for the fucking flight, it just says destination nowhere. And I was fucking dying because I'd never noticed that either. And I was like... This is Neil's hell. It truly is. Neil starts calling around looking for a hotel room, hostel, anything, but everything's booked. Del asks him how it's going, and Neil learns that Del here has already booked himself a room. So Del says if Neil picks up the cab fare, Del will make sure he gets a room where he's staying. He hooked the owner up with some sweet shower curtain rings, so he has an inn. Neil's a little reluctant here. Del is not someone he seems to be able to be around. And yeah, Del is loud and out there and 1,000,000,000% neurodivergent, like I've already said, but here we are again. But Neil kind of feels like he's blander than vanilla when he wants some spumoni. And yeah, I might never want to share a plane ride with Del, but you know what? A cab ride would be just fine. I just want to note real quick, Steve Martin in this role is so weird to me because while there is some, I guess, physical comedy to this character in a way, you know, I feel like Steve Martin, I don't even know how to describe that correctly. His facial expressions, you know, the way he moves his body along with what he's saying, I feel like that brings so much life to the comedy part of what he does within his characters. But Neil, he's not a funny guy. Like, he's just not. Again, blander than vanilla when you want spumoni. So it's just a weird contrast to see Steve Martin in this kind of role. And while the character is still funny because of what's happening to him, it's just different, but I still love the experience. Anyways, they catch a cab, not just any cab. It's this fucking cab. It's a cab with personalized license plates that says Wolf, and Doobie's Taxiola is painted on the side of it. There's photos of women in various states of undress taped to the ceiling of the car. Along the sides, there's tassels and puffballs lining the interior of the car, and the music is blaring.
Where the hell is the motel?
Newbie, is it much farther?
Not much.
Why didn't you take the interstate?
You said your friend had never been around here, so I just figured he'd like to look around. Don't see nothing on the interstate but interstate.
The middle of the night.
I know, but he's proud of his town. You know, that's a damn rare thing these days.
This fucking guy, toothpick hanging out of his trap, takes them the long way to their digs for the night, okay? Dude was absolutely doing this for the higher cab fare. Am I wrong? Maybe. But he's taking them the long ass fucking way. And I'm like, this has literally happened to me once when I lived in Tucson. We had just flown back home into Tucson. And I knew the quicker route to get home. But the taxi guy, he took us this long ass way. Like, no, it'll be quicker. It was not quicker. It ended up costing more money than we had in cash. I didn't have much experience with this kind of stuff at the time, but it was the whole thing. It was the middle of the night. It was so uncomfortable. Neil seems super unimpressed with the inn. Del, however, is all gusto. They get checked in. During the process, their diner's club cards get swapped. It's the card that they hand the guy at the desk when he asks for a major credit card to have on file. They end up getting swapped during this transaction, so they've got each other's cards instead of their own. And then they learn that they're going to be sharing a room that has just one double bed. Listen, I don't even want to share a double bed with myself, let alone anyone else. Both of them get real uncomfortable when they realize the bed situation and they don't know what to say or do. So they end up shooting for awkward small talk. Neil is literally like checking for dust that is like on a shelf, trying to avoid the whole bed situation and, you know, commenting on it.
Cab ride, yeah, yeah, it was a great cab ride. You don't see cabs like that too often, you know.
And then Del asks Neil if he wants to take a shower.
You want to take a shower?
No.
No, I meant if you want to go first or not. you thought I... Well, you think I am? Yeah,
no. Neil takes his shower after Del, and I hate this scene. I really don't like this scene. It's a sensory thing. Yet again, here we are. It's in kind of an old, just feels gross from looking at it, motel, roadside inn, bathroom that looks like it hasn't been anything but moist a day in its life. Adele used all the towels except for one lone washcloth, okay? The floor is wet. There's clumps of wet newspaper that looked like someone had been reading on the shitter and just dropped it in a puddle on the bathroom floor after that. I don't know. Meanwhile, in the room, Del is settling in. He gets his hypoallergenic pillow out of his trunk. He puts an 8x10 photo headshot of his wife on the bedside table, and then he lights up a cigarette, all while Neil is struggling with the monsoon Del set off in the bathroom and didn't clean up. Del is absolutely the friend you have no idea isn't the cleanest person, maybe struggles with hygiene for various reasons, whatever, until you get in their car. He even slides a quarter in the vibrating bed machine and takes a little vibrating ride as he pops open a beer and watches TV. Del, I adore you, but some of these habits would be better reserved for when it's just you, okay? They go to bed. Neil is trying to settle in and relax, but he can't because the bed situation, but also because...
I had no idea those beer cans were going to blow like that.
Left him on a vibrating bed. What did you think was gonna happen?
It's been a long day. Just didn't occur to me.
Why the fuck isn't Del sleeping on that side of the bed? Why the fuck isn't Del sleeping on that side of the bed? If it's his fault, he did it, which he did. I don't... Why? Sleep in a puddle of beer. No. Del is still doing Del things, like trying to read by way of a lighter. He's cracking his knuckles, neck, and back. He's like me.
Oh my god, am I being punished for something?
I did not plan that, but yes, that was my neck. Neil's face is saying he wants to kill Del as he lays there in silent rage. And he breaks when Neil starts clearing his throat.
Why? What? That's it. If I don't clear my sinuses, I'll snore all night.
Gee, if your kid spills his milk, what do you do, slap him in the head?
What is that supposed to mean?
You're not a very tolerant person.
Look, you've been under my skin since New York, starting with ripping off my cab.
God, you're a tight ass.
Okay, Del, that's just not the same thing. Spilled milk and blowing your mouth horn like it's a competition when the other person in the bed next to you was trying to sleep is not the same thing. It's not the same fucking thing. Neil breaks. He throws himself out of bed. He's angry, doesn't want to be there. He starts packing his bag like he's gonna leave. They're bickering back and forth for a bit. Del goes straight to self-righteous a bit here. Unfortunately, Del can be kind of unapologetic in his habits, like everything he was just doing there. And I know that that's just him being himself, doing what he needs to do to like settle in for the night. But I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know what the compromise is here. But he just gets a bit self-righteous and defensive. I don't not understand that. It's just unfortunately not the right move. But then Neil gets mean.
Well, go ahead. Sleep in the lobby. See if I care. I hope you wake up so stiff you can't even move.
You're no saint. You got a free cab. You got a free room. And someone who'll listen to your boring stories. I mean, didn't you notice on the plane when you started talking, eventually I started reading the vomit bag? Didn't that give you some sort of clue? Like, hey, maybe this guy's not enjoying it?
Neil turns into a bit of a bully here. I get it. He has no tolerance left. He's exhausted. He just wants to get home. Traveling, you know, especially if it sounds like he travels a lot for his work, like it gets fucking tiring. Sitting in airports, being stuck there, being in unfamiliar places, all of that. And again, Del is unapologetic when he shouldn't be at times. They're both in a crappy situation. My note says crampy situation. I guess that too. But Neil kind of goes for the jugular here.
Your stories have none of that. They're not even amusing accidentally. Honey, I'd like you to meet Del Griffith. He's got some amusing anecdotes for you. Oh, and here's a gun so you can blow your brains out. You'll thank me for it. I could tolerate any insurance seminar. For days, I could sit there and listen to them go on and on with a big smile on my face. And I'd say, how can you stand it? And I'd say, because I've been with Del Griffith. I can take anything. You know what that'd say? That'd say, I know what you mean. The shower curtain ring guy. Whoa.
Yeah, so just straight for the open wound and just like stick the fucking knife in, apparently is what Neil is doing. Del looks like he wishes the room would swallow him alive, like he might cry. Big same. And Neil just keeps going.
It's like going on a date with a chatty Kathy doll. I expect you to have a little string on your chest, you know, that I pull out and have to snap back. Except I wouldn't pull it out and snap it back. You would. And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
When Neil finally finishes, Del speaks. And this speech, it's short, but it gets me every fucking time.
You want to hurt me? Go right ahead if it makes you feel any better. I'm an easy target. Yeah, you're right. I talk too much. I also listen too much. I could be a cold-hearted cynic like you. But I don't like to hurt people's feelings. Well, you think what you want about me. I'm not changing. I like me. My wife likes me. My customers like me. Because I'm the real article. What you see is what you get.
This speech makes me feel so many things. So many fucking things. It's probably my favorite scene. We already knew that these were two very different people, right? But this is where I feel it more, not just see it or hear it, you know? Neil is this 9-to-5 wife and two kids, a dog, quiet suburbia advertisement schmuck who sees life as this thing that has one way to live, but he actually seems to be filled with disdain at how inconvenient he finds the world when things don't go his way, when things stray outside of the plan and structure he has set for himself. But he lets it build and build until he's yelling at a stranger for how different they are. Fuck, the more I think about it, the more I start to feel like Neil Page isn't so much a pillar of neurotypicalness, but a glaring example of how societal structures can be harmful to the human experience in general. He's so fucking wound up, he can't even properly let out his rage. For God's sake, he still whisper screams at the rental desk lady later in the movie, in the fuck speech, we'll get to that, like he's trying to censor himself for the sake of being in public. Even in the room with Del, he was mean, straight for the jugular. But there's still the sense of him kind of trying to contain it in a way. And then there's Del, trudging along, so clearly neurodivergent, ADHD up the wazoo, painfully unaware of the trail of crackerjack crumbs he leaves behind. A guy who seems selfish as hell, but given the chance to see himself clearly, might recognize that there's a reason he is the way he is beyond, you know, in quotes, this is just how I am. Because if Delahir is neurodivergent, that in itself is disabling in a world that accommodates itself so readily for neurotypicalness, but reduces neurodivergence to something people think is taboo to talk about, to something so many people deny as real, that choose to not understand it because it's outside of their experience, or because the neurodivergent experience resonates with them and they don't know how to handle it. But most of all, this is where I start to feel like these two very different individuals are learning about one another. They're learning about one another in sort of the reverse, because they're seeing, it's like when you're making a new friend, you know, they don't have a complete picture of you until you spend more time with them, maybe go on vacation with them, a day trip, spend some time at their house, get in their car. They're seeing the uglier sides of each other in a way. And I don't really like using the word ugly there. I just can't seem to conjure the correct word out of my head, because I feel like that's saying that, you know, these habits that Del has, for example, are ugly. They're not ugly. It's just, you know, that is who Del is. But he's seeing how he affects people by way of Neil. And then in the reverse, Del is seeing how cut off Neil almost seems to be to himself and how that affects him. Anyways, Neil gets back in bed and somehow they both fall asleep. And now this dude is gonna rob them. Some guy breaks into their room and steals all the cash out of their wallets. The next morning, we see Del big spooning Neil covered in Cracker Jack crumbs. The bedside table on Del's side is just littered in fucking trash, like he's been there for a week. And Del is smooching Neil's ear.
Del. Mm. Why did you kiss my ear? Why are you holding my hand? Where's your other hand? Between two pillows. Those aren't pillows.
As they fly out of bed, this is where we kind of see Steve Martin's physical comedy a little bit. His limb shaking, and I don't even know how to describe it. You're such a see it. I finally noticed the two grimy handprints on either side of the painting hanging above the bed, and I realize I don't think anyone has ever cleaned this fucking room. They resort to sports to break the accidental intimacy uncomfortableness.
See that Bears game last week?
Yeah, hell of a game, hell of a game. Bears got a great team this year. They're gonna go all the way.
The Bears! The Bears!
Yo, there's Cracker Jack crumbs all over Del's pajama bottom ass, and it just really cracks me up. Also, I wanted to note here that this scene, you know, the morning after they wake up and they're, you know, big spoon, little spooning. And one of the things I was reading about the behind the scenes stuff of the film, John Hughes, the song that plays before they would shoot the scene, he would play that song for them. And there's, I had read this, I forget what it said exactly, but it's a quote from Steve Martin talking about that and how it really got them into the heart of that scene, set the mood, I guess. I don't know how to say that correctly, but I just kind of loved that little tidbit. Anyway, so they have breakfast together and conclude that flying is no longer an option if they're going to make it home on time. It's time for the trains portion of Neil and Del's dilemma. But first they argue about their cash being missing. Neil accuses Del of taking his money, but they find that Del has also been robbed. So that settles that. Neil was carrying $700 in cash. Del, I think around 250, a little over 200, something like that. I can't imagine doing that ever. Listen, I know it's 1987. It was a different time, but that's a lot of fucking money. I guess to me anyway. They discuss what kinds of cards they have, and Del says that he has this card from this big and tall clothing chain in the Pacific Northwest.
What have you got? Chalmers Big and Tall Man Shop. It's a 7-outlet chain in the Pacific Northwest. Great stuff. Unfortunately, it does us no good here.
It's a reference to my home, so you know, I had to mention it. I love that shit. We learn that Gus, so this is where we meet Owen.
I'm to drive you to Wichita to catch a train?
Yeah, we'd appreciate it.
Train don't run out of Wichita.
Hmm?
Unless you're a hog or a cattle. People, train runs out of Stubville.
That'll be fine. That'd be great. That'll be just fine.
He pulls up in a single cab truck with his son and wife, who's holding a baby, so there's two kids. He looks like he only knows how to run on chewing tobacco and anger. He's absolutely got a fat wad of chewing tobacco in his lip. Every time he spits, I want to slap him. He's rolling shit 3.0. He demands his wife get out of the truck and put their Del and Neil's luggage in the back. Del and Neil protest to this, and Owen here says,
"She's short and skinny, but she's strong. Her first baby come out sideways. She didn't scream or nothing.
Isn't that something?"
All right. Well, they're finally off to the train station. They put their luggage in the back themselves. They were like, absolutely fucking not. This is insanity. This whole interaction, these people, what the fuck is happening? They have to ride in the back of this truck, though, down the highway. Listen, guys, there's snow everywhere. It's cold as shit. Essentially, they spend this whole trip just cold. It sounds miserable. At the train station, they kind of part ways here. Neil gets them tickets, and I think he makes sure that they aren't seated together because Del called ahead.
"Oh, I knew it. You know, I the secretary was new and I explained it. Oh, I'm sorry."
So Del seems really bummed here. He's saying, "Well, let's meet for a drink in the bar car." But Neil says he wants to get some sleep, so probably not. And Del realizes that what Neil is saying is, "I don't want to spend any more time with you." Del's face is smiling, but his eyes are sad. I think this is just another one of those things that I relate to a lot because I kind of have this habit of misunderstanding my relationship or lack thereof with people, and I'll blow up the relationship in my head, friendship, whatever kind of relationship it is, to more than it is. And when you realize the other person actually isn't your friend, it's not on them for my misperception, but it hurts a lot. It fucking hurts a lot. And that's what I see in Del's face here. Neil seems happy to be Del free. He's making small talk with who I think is a college student headed home for the holidays. He's grinning like a motherfucker. My dudes, small talk is a painful fucking experience to me. It feels so lifeless and meaningless. Therefore, I hate it. And that's like this interaction here. Like, he's smiling and giddy and, you know, making his little bit of small talk. And then, you know, you're done with that. So then you can just like be on your own. But I don't know. I guess I might prefer to have Adele next to me, as long as, you know, when I was like, okay, I'm done talking now, they took that seriously, which we know Adele has a problem with. So anyways, almost as soon as Neil is feeling like, yeah, I'm gonna make it home, and he's got that big old smile slapped across his face, it's replaced with a big old frown, and the train breaks down. Everyone unloads and is told to walk a mile and a half to the road where some means of transportation will pick them up and take them to a bus station. Neil is looking ill with disdain. Del walks by him and they share a glance, but they don't say anything. And Del he goes to pick up his trunk and his luggage and starts making the trek back to the road. But then Neil comes up behind him, still not saying anything. And he picks up the other end of the trunk and he helps him carry it to the road. Okay, y'all, it's time for a bus ride. We see them seated at a bus station in Jefferson City, Montana. So we started in New York City, ended up in Wichita. Now we're in Montana. Neil is quiet, but without a doubt, dying inside. Del is still talking.
"You ever traveled by bus before?" "Your mood's probably not going to improve much."
The bus is packed. There's a kid running up and down the aisle. A couple is going at it, just eating each other's faces. I mean, making out. Del gives me the ick for a moment here when he says,
"It's a movie on a plane, huh?"
Then the couple catches them watching, mostly Neil, because he's seated in the aisle seat. Del is cracking up.
"Why don't you take a picture to last longer?"
"You got busted." "Oh, that was good."
And then we learn that their tickets are only good till St. Louis. They get to St. Louis and Del goes into salesman mode, trying to make some cash by selling shower curtain rings as earrings.
"This is your Diane Sawyer autographed earring. You ever watch 60 Minutes? Thanks. This is Czechoslovakian ivory. That's $5. Great. This is your Walter Cronkite moon ring."
I love this scene. This is maybe my second favorite scene. It's quick, but when Del goes into his salesman mode and you see these women buying shower curtain rings and you actually see them wearing them as earrings, it's just so absurd to me that I kind of love it. Del and Neil, they sit down for a meal after Del's made some cash, and Neil is gloomy because he tried calling home and no one answered, and he knows he's missing a school thing for his kid. Del makes it worse by saying that the wrong thing.
"You missed it. I'm sorry. Those are the precious moments too.
They don't come back again.
Del, my dude, that's not the way. Neil says he's away from home too much, and Del replies that he hasn't been home in years, and Neil, he's kind of like, seriously? Years? And then Del sort of backtracks a little bit, saying it was just a figure of speech. Now Neil goes into this fake as fuck speech about how he's been holding Del back and they shouldn't continue on together and Del would do better without him, and he wants to part ways. He's trying to make it out like Neil is the reason why things have been going wrong. And honestly, he just isn't doing that great of a job here with this little speech because he's avoiding being honest. He thinks he's being polite by not being honest, but he isn't. This isn't the way, Neil. Adela's reading between the lines. He decides to leave. He leaves some cash for the meal. He tries to leave some extra cash to pay back Neil for the train ticket. Neil won't accept it. It's a whole thing. Del gets fed up and he leaves. Now Neil tries to rent a car, but when he's dropped off at the car lot, the car he was given keys for isn't there. Listen, the car rental place is at the airport in St. Louis. He had to take a shuttle to get to the fucking car lot from the airport. So now he's stuck yet again in the cold, the snow, having to walk, I want to say it's about 3 miles back to the rental desk inside the airport. Neil isn't handling this well. Honestly, big same, my dude. You know, I wouldn't handle this well either. He makes it back inside, wrecked and ready to rumble with anyone. Listen, he's about to socially implode when, of course, the woman working the desk couldn't give two fucks about her job. And you know what? I get it. But Neil here, well, Neil doesn't.
Yeah, well, I'll see you tomorrow then. Gobble, gobble. Oh, bye-bye. Welcome to Marathon. May I help you?
So now Neil gives his fuck speech.
How may I help you?
You can start by wiping that fucking dumbass smile off your rosy fucking cheeks. Then you can give me a fucking automobile, a fucking Datsun, a fucking Toyota, a fucking Mustang, a fucking Buick, 4 fucking wheels and a seat.
I really don't care for the way you're speaking to me.
And I really don't care for the way your company left me in the middle of fucking nowhere with fucking keys to a fucking car that isn't fucking there. And I really didn't care to fucking walk down a fucking highway and across a fucking runway to get back here to have you smile at my fucking face. I want a fucking car right fucking now.
Level-toned fuck speech. I don't think I've heard someone say the word fuck like this before. The woman listens as he goes off, and then she asks for his rental agreement, but he doesn't have it. He threw it in his rage, doesn't have it anymore. So she says,
oh boy.
Oh boy, what?
You're fucked.
Okay, guys, Neil decides he's going to get a cab back home. Yes, this is ridiculous and not going to work out. And the taxi guy working the curb, helping people get a cab. But when Neil approaches him and he asks where to, Neil says Chicago. He says you'd be better flying, even get a free meal out of it. And he's just trying to help, but Neil has gone full asshole.
If I wanted a joke, I'd follow you into the John and watch you take a leak.
The taxi guy doesn't take kindly to this, so he punches him, just straight up punches this motherfucker. Neil has taken so many hits, and for the second time in this movie, he lands in the road on his back, laid the fuck out. Just as Neil falls to the ground in the street, Del comes screeching up in his rental car, almost running him over. Del gets out, super concerned. Then he demands that the taxi guy help Neil after he calls him an insensitive asshole.
What is your problem? You insensitive asshole!
He sounds so much like Paul Giamatti for a moment here when he says this line. I wish I can't do a Paul Giamatti, but if I could, I would. So hopefully you hear it too, but just the way he says it, I can so clearly in my head hear Paul Giamatti saying it. I'm like, wait, is Paul here? God, I love that guy. So the taxi guy does help Neil up by way of ball dragging him to the curb. Del and Neil are back together once again, and off they go.
I've never seen a guy get picked up by his testicles before.
Lucky thing for you, that cop passed by when he did. Otherwise, you'd be lifting up your schnutz to tie your shoes. I'm sorry. That's terrible. Do you have any idea how glad I am I didn't kill you?
Do you have any idea how glad I'd be if you had?
Neil's voice is high-pitched, like he sucked the helium out of a balloon or just straight up took a hit out of the fucking helium canister. Meanwhile, his face is saying he died and came back to life reluctantly. So they're going to drive the rest of the way in this rental car home, right? So eventually they switch seats. Del started out driving. Now Neil is driving. They're taking turns. Teamwork. That's fucking teamwork. Our guy Del can't get comfy in the passenger seat, and they quibble about it. Then they argue about Del not taking his shoes off because Neil is finally, you know, speaking up. And I'm like, thank you, Neil. This feels cathartic because I also have a hard time speaking up, but you finally did. But Del gets defensive when Neil asks him to not take his fucking shoes off because his feet stink. And Del's all like, must be nice to not have issues with body odor. And I'm like, if you consistently have stinky feet, I don't know if there's a solution for that, but like maybe get some foot odor spray. Maybe look into like, do you have like a fungal thing happening? I don't know. I've never had an issue with this in my life. Del seems to have a consistent issue with it. Anyways, Del gets defensive and says that Neil does plenty of things that are annoying. He's kind of searching for something for a second here. And then he says, like playing with his balls. Neil is just... Y'all, I'm not a dude, so I can't try to understand this experience. But I've heard from guys that, you know, sometimes you just got to readjust things. I don't know if you're really readjusting that much. Like, I don't like, do you just get, what do you do? Is that just how it is? Do you get bigger man underwear? You know what? If you got to readjust for comfort, do what you got to do. That's all. That's all I'm going to say, I guess. Eventually they switch seats again, but now the passenger seat is broken and Neil is perturbed, okay? Neil ends up falling asleep, a deep sleep, apparently. I don't understand this unless he took some fucking drugs, which if you need to, like, you know, be safe about it, it's fine. Del has himself a little dance party. Ah, you can talk about the pit, barbecue, the band was jumping, the people too, ah, mess around. They're doing the mess around. Okay, see, the thing is, Del can't keep the car straight in the lane while he car dances. Big same. Like, big fucking same. Okay? So no hate here. That's why I can't go hard if I car dance. Because I just, bad things will happen. Similar to what happens here with Del. Can't keep the car straight in the lane while he car dances and is having a grand old time. He's smoking a cigarette. He's jamming and swerving to Ray Charles. He flicks his cigarette out the window, or at least he tries to because the window is barely cracked. And it bounces off, still lit, even though it's kind of a stub, and lands in the back seat. But Del doesn't realize this. He has no idea that the cigarette landed in the back seat. Okay. He starts to get warm because the lit cigarette stub is slowly lighting the seat on fire in the back. So he tries to take his coat off. He moves to take one arm out of it and the little loop on the wrist of the jacket to, I think, tighten the sleeve, maybe? Anyways, it gets stuck on the seat adjustment at Del's hip on the right, okay? With his arm still in the jacket sleeve. So now he's just got one arm to drive with. He's struggling. He can't get it loose. So he decides to try to get his other arm out of the jacket, except that side gets stuck as well. So now both of his arms are stuck at his side. He can't get them fucking loose because he can't even see enough to see what the shit is stuck on, okay? So now he's just driving down the highway, kind of armless. He doesn't want to wake up Neil to ask for help. Well, because, you know, Neil's gonna be mad. He's not trying to do more things to make Neil hate him. So he doesn't want Neil to know that this is happening. So he ends up trying to drive with his fucking knees. He finally kind of rips his arms loose from the jacket. As he does this, the car spins out. He screams. He slams his feet on the brakes. This finally wakes Neil up, who suggests Del take his coat off because it's getting warm in the car. And then he goes back to sleep. And Del's like, yeah, that's a good idea. Del somehow managed to exit the freeway in all of this hullabaloo. So he moves to get back on the freeway. But when he does re-enter the freeway, he doesn't realize that he's entered on an exit ramp, not an on-ramp. Clearly a problem. As you can imagine, this doesn't go well. No, not at all. A driver on the opposite side of the freeway sees Del driving the wrong way and decides to do something about it.
Holy shit, look at that guy on the wrong side of the highway. He's going to kill somebody.
Middle of the night, so there aren't many cars on the road, you know, minus the two semi trucks making their way down the two-lane highway, freeway, whatever the fuck it's called, towards Del and Neil. So this is a fucking problem. Del thinks the people trying to signal to them you're going the wrong way are trying to race them.
The Joker wants to race.
Christ, that's ridiculous.
All right, come on. Let's go. Let's go.
Oh, my dude. Because he thinks he's going the right way. So he's like, I'm not going. What the fuck is this? Neil wakes up again, but is super out of it at first. But then he realizes the other driver is signaling for them to roll down the window. So he does. The guy is screaming at them.
You're going the wrong way!
But since they think they are going the right way, Del says,
oh, he's drunk! How would he know where we're going?
The backseat is billowing smoke now. Just as Neil snaps out of his sleep enough to realize Del is in fact going the wrong fucking direction on the freeway, they meet the two semis and drive straight through the middle of them. It's terrifying. They're both screaming as metal on metal is just like fucking rubbing together down the length of these semis because there isn't enough room for this car, but it's still happening. Neil is so fucking scared that Del turns into this devil creature laughing at him, only turning back into real Del once they come out the other end of the trucks. After a moment of shock, Del pulls the car off to the side of the road. His luggage that was strapped to the top of the car is all over the highway. They get out. They're kind of in shock. At this point, they're standing on the road. We see a road sign that says 102 miles to Chicago. So, like, they're fucking close. And then they both just start laughing.
What?
What?
You finally did it to yourself. I mean, good luck turning the car in. I mean, they're going to be happy as pigs and shit to see you.
I think for Neil, this is sort of shock, trauma, how the fuck is this in my existence right now response. We also learn here that Del used Neil's card to rent the car, the Diners Club card thing. And now Neil properly loses it.
You stole it!
Not exactly!
You stole
no,
my
I swear
card!
My life,
I know
did.
You stole it!
I did not
you
steal
stole
your
my
card!
And then you
I
rented
didn't.
A car! And then you burned it up!
I did not! I found it in my
I
wallet!
I knew you stole it!
I thought you put it there!
In tried and true Del fashion, he gets defensive of his actions without much apology. Neil demands he give the card back, but Del says he already did. He slipped it into Neil's wallet when Neil wasn't in the car because Neil had put his wallet in the glove compartment before he got some car sleep. So Del thought he could just, you know, put it back in there and he'd be none the wiser. The glove compartment of that car is actively on fire. So Neil's wallet and the last remaining bits of way to pay for any means of transportation is now burnt to a crisp. Then, I love this part, Del asks the most Ellen from I Think Not podcast question ever.
Are you mad at me?
Del must have been channeling some Ellen that night and had no idea because when I heard him say this, I died. I died of laughter. If you have not listened to I Think Not, this is my random shout out to them. I fucking love you guys. Anyways, back to Del and Neil on the side of the road with this car on fire. Y'all, Neil just gut punches him in response. Somehow they drive the crispy rental car to a roadside inn. Del keeps talking at Neil, but Neil won't speak to him. Neil gets himself a room after haggling because, you know, again, every card in his wallet is crispier than the car and can't be used. He pays part cash, part expensive watch. Del has no way to pay for a room, and since Neil is currently pretending like Del doesn't exist, Del just tucks himself back into the burnt car, the burnmobile. I don't know what to call it. It starts to snow. The car is basically a convertible now. As Del sits in the snowfall, he says,
well, Marie, once again, my dear, you were as right as rain. I am, without a doubt, the biggest pain in the butt that ever came down the pike. I meet someone whose company I really enjoy. What do? I go overboard. I smother the poor soul. I cause him more trouble than he has a right to.
From Neil's room, he sees that it's snowing and that Del is trying to sleep in the convertibleized car. He calls him inside. His anger seemingly run its course. And now they basically have an adult slumber party. They're drinking mini bottles of alcohol. They're laughing, talking about the most random of things. They seem a little drunk, a little tipsy. They must have gotten some snacks from a vending machine or something. Della has spilled potato chips all over the fucking floor. Neil even seems to be enjoying himself. I like this part because they're starting to seem like real friends here. Neil moves to say goodnight to Del, turns off the bedside lamp, and he says Del is one unique individual. And Del replies,
"What is unique? Latin for asshole?"
Neil says one day I'll look back on this whole experience and laugh at this. But Del says,
"You think so?"
Oh, I'm laughing already.
Oh, God.
Oh, when that car blew up.
Was that seat hot or what? That's like a big whopper. Turn me over, I'm done on this side.
It's the next morning, and they're really going to try to drive this crisp mobile the last 100 miles. Del is trying to get the car out of the freshly fallen snow, but ends up backing into the office of the inn. They don't want to wait around for anyone to notice who done it, so they just fucking leave. They just leave the scene of the crime. They've barely started to cruise down the road when they get pulled over. This is where we see Michael McKean. He's the cop. He's the state trooper. He was on SNL. And then he was in films like Spinal Tap, Clue, Coneheads. He pulls them over. They were going about 78, but had no idea because the speedometer thing was burnt to hell. There's no way in hell that our cop guy was ever going to let them keep driving this fucking thing. Del sort of argues with him. Del, you were always going to lose this argument. It's not happening. The car gets impounded, and the cop guy at least gives them a ride to the police station, where Del finds a truck driver to drive them the last 100 miles to Chicago. But they have to ride in the back with the cargo, which is being kept cold because it's just boxes of cheese. They make it back to Chicago and are dropped off at the railway station. They share a warm goodbye, like a friendly goodbye this time. Neil's disdain is gone. Del's sad to part ways. They even hug. Neil says, "Say hi to Marie for me. I feel like I know her." And off he goes. Marie being Del's wife. Neil takes his seat, and as the rail car is moving along, he starts thinking about his wife and kids, the meal he's about to enjoy, just being home. Then his mind flashes to Del, a Del highlight reel of sorts. Big spoon Del, the two of them laughing after the car lit on fire. Neil's kind of chuckling to himself and smiling, like they're memories he truly doesn't want to forget. He flashes back to laying into Del and Del's response.
I like me. My wife likes me.
And then he flashes back to just the night before and Del's face when he said to him,
"At the very least, the absolute minimum. Got a woman you love to grow old with."
And Del's response, "Love is not a big enough word for how I feel about my wife." Del saying he hasn't been home in years.
"I've been home for years."
So instead of going home, he goes back to the rail station where he just parted ways with Del. And lo and behold, there's Del.
"Del, what are you doing here?" "You said you were going home. What are you doing here?" I don't have a home. Marie's been dead for 8 years.
Neil sort of takes a long pause after what Del just admitted to him, that he's essentially been homeless for the past 8 years. Everything's clicking into place. And I think Del starts to make a lot more sense to Neil. Del was unanchored when he lost his wife, and he's been traveling from location to location, avoiding going home, working, not dealing with his grief well, if at all, lonely and sinking into bad habits, unable to catch himself. And it's not that Neil is catching him. No, it's not that. Neil's becoming his friend, someone who cares about him, someone who wants to be there for him. So we see the two of them walking down Neil's street, carrying Neil's trunk, coming home together. Neil's family is all there. Neil is hugging everyone, introducing Del. Neil's wife comes down the stairs and Neil and her share a moment. Then Neil introduces her to Del, and Del's face, fuck man, his face is full of pain, but also love at the same time. Like he's trying not to cry. He looks down for a moment, collecting himself, and when he looks back up, he's smiling. Smiling that beautiful John Candy smile, and the film ends. The end. Oh my God. Okay, so I bawl my eyes out every time because I'm a fucking crier, like I've already said. Essentially, this movie kind of fused itself to my existence because in a kind of roundabout way, I saw so much of myself in both of these people. And honestly, my first rewatch of this, it kind of took me a bit to realize that because at first I was like, well, this is like a whole ass story about a neurotypical person becoming friends with a neurodivergent person. But honestly, a little bit of me is like, Neil can be so rigid and not deal with change well, and he's trudging along in his ways, but he's like pissed about it because it's, you know, he's living life by way of these, you know, set bullshit social standards that we all thought we were supposed to live by, but you know, it's really fucking unrealistic and unhealthy. For me, in a way, Neil's character feels a bit like the autism side of me, and Del feels like the ADHD side of me. It's much more complicated than that, and it's not like an exact representation. It just, I'm sorry, I'm not verbalizing this very well. I just fucking spoken so much about this already. But I kind of started to realize that I was just seeing two different halves of myself on the screen coming out in these different ways, because it's like I feel so conflicted within my own brain a lot of the time with how I experience life as an autistic person, but also as someone with inattentive ADD. I know I always say ADHD, but listen, inattentive ADD is a mouthful to me, and I feel like when you just say ADD, people are like, what the fuck is that? So I just end up saying ADHD. But it's like these two sides of myself are constantly fucking battling each other, fighting for purchase, fighting for understanding, fighting to come out in the way that they need to. And I see that a lot between these characters. I don't know if that's making any fucking sense. I hope it is. Then there's Del and Del's pain and how he's just been circling the country for 8 fucking years, lost and sad and alone, but covering it up by just being himself, but like covering it up at the same time. And I guess I just feel so alone in my head a lot of the time that I don't know, I just connected with this movie in a very visceral way that I feel like doesn't make sense. And I don't feel like I'm talking about it in a way that is making sense, but I guess I don't have the words to properly explain it, so I just, you know, hoping that it fucking makes sense. I don't know what the final runtime of this episode's gonna be, but you know what, it's probably gonna be longer than usual. I guess that's something this episode will have in common with the 3-hour-long version of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles that none of us will ever see, but I kind of wish I could. For my next movie, I'm going to be doing Miss Congeniality. Yes. Yes, Miss Congeniality. Sandra Bullock, Benjamin Bratt, among others. It's going to be a grand fucking time. I look out for the trailer for that after my outro music. I did forget to say, I wanted to say this earlier in the episode, and I forgot, you can watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles for free with ads on YouTube. So if you'd like to give it a watch, if you haven't seen it in a long time, you can hop on over there, check it out. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sticking around for this fucking mess. I feel like this is a fucking mess. Hopefully it's not. We will see. Thanks again. Okay, bye.
I'm afraid to look at my ass, you know? I'm gonna have those griddle marks on my ass.
8, you might want to stay out of this, all right, sir?
All right. I would like 8 double tall lattes, 1 with no foam.
Special Agent Gracie Hart is as tough as nails.
She's got a lot of rage.
And she's completely unpolished.
Honey, are you a lesbian?
Dad. I wish.
But when the FBI needs an undercover agent...
The bombers picked another target.
We have ourselves a national emergency.
It's the Miss United States pageant.
The only man for the job is a woman.
You do a few butt-shaping exercises, you tighten this up, you can pull this off.
You know what? Pull this off.
Let's go, girl.
These people want to put one of their agents in the pageant.
Do you have an agent in mind? Sorry.
She doesn't look the part.
There's no way on earth that I can make this woman ready in 2 days. She's Dirty Harriet.
She doesn't act the part.
Come on, have some Midnight John, some girl talk.
We can't have
pizza and beer.
It's light beer, and she's going to throw it up anyway.
She doesn't want the part.
I'm not going to parade around in a swimsuit like some airhead bimbo.
Describe your perfect date.
I'd have to say April 25th.
But she's about to prove anything is possible.
I have gel in my hair. I haven't slept all night. I'm starved, and I'm armed. Don't mess with me. I'm fine.
This December.
You're doing a great job.
You think I'm cool? Just you wanna date me?
Get ready.
Gun! Everybody down!
For the new face of the FBI.
Of course he had a gun. This is Texas. Everybody has a gun. My florist has a gun.
Miss Congeniality.
What is the one thing our society needs?
World peace.
World peace.
World peace.
Harsher punishment for a parole violator, Stan. And world peace.